Welcome to the convalescent home that is the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. It's the place where we gather around to kibitz, complain about the world at large, about music, about movies we don't like, about things we do. But I think it's appropriate this week because my house has been like a convalescent home. Is convalescent the right term? It's kind of where you recuperate?
That's where you convalesce, yes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, then I'm using it correctly. And even if I wasn't, I don't care because I'm not in the mood. You've had the stomach flu recently?
No, I've been avoiding it. But if I get it via this podcast, I'm going to be really angry with you.
I'm going to cough through the microphone and give it to you. I don't even know how you get the stomach flu. All I know is my son had it on Saturday and got home from work and he just was a mess, right? Like throwing up every 20 minutes. So I just had to sit with him and finally, you know, got him to bed super early and everything. And then Sunday, you know, my wife and I managed to avoid it somehow. We thought, okay, everything's good, you know. He's doing better. It was a one-day bug. We emailed the rest of his daycare class, and like five other kids had it. And said it only lasted a day. It's like, all right, good. So, and then Monday hits. Both my wife and I wake up, and we both end up having to rush into the bathroom almost immediately. So we spent the whole day convalescing.
I see. Do you have a double bowl in there?
We did. We have a double sink, but my wife ran over to the potty. And I ran over to the sink, and the rest of the day continued like that. It was a lot of fun.
That's definitely the way to identify a parent from a non-parent. Toilet has become potty.
Yeah, true. Yeah, and no food. I mean, that's the thing. Like no food all day. So I had stepped on the scale on Sunday just to see my weight post vacation time, which was on the up and up, right? So it was like 182 instead of where I wanted it to be, which was like, you know, in the 170s.
I see.
So today I stepped on the scale after one day of no food and not being able to drink any water or anything. And it was at 177. Man, this diet's working, man.
Right on. P90X, forget about that.
Right. Forget P90X or that thing that Chuck Norris promotes.
I don't know what that is.
I'm gonna start from now on. I'm gonna actually create a diet plan that is, you know, you and I should work on this. We should create an infomercial, like a half hour infomercial. And here's the secret to weight loss, because you know you put it on late night television. You get a lot of fatties.
Is that when they watch TV?
I guess that's why they always target it, right? When I'm up at work at 3 a.m. and I flip on the TV before the show, and I'm just like looking to flip around the news and stuff. There's always a commercial for people who, like, I guess either are insomniacs, or, you know, they can't sleep, so they think, oh, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to watch an infomercial, and it's like P90X in the middle of the night, and they must know that these work, right? Because that's when they're always on television. They're targeting people who are like just down on their luck, who are up in the middle of the night. Who are overweight, and they think, you know what, I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to buy this P90X, and then I'm going to start working out, and then I won't be up in the middle of the night anymore.
I won't be up in the middle of the night. It could just be, you know, like they're so lazy, they can't reach the TV to turn it off, and like the remote's batteries aren't working.
And it's just on, and they wake up, and they like their hand, like that guy on Toy Story 2, he just rolls over and his hand's in a box of Cheetos. And they need like Jesse or Woody to jump down. See how many I watched Toy Story 3 times yesterday.
Wow. I've only ever seen the original in its entirety. I've just seen excerpts of the others.
Yeah, Toy Story is excellent. It's amazing, though, if you look at it on Rotten Tomatoes, it has 100%. Mm-hmm. I think Toy Story 2 has like a 98%. Mm. And Toy Story 3, I think, also has 100%.
Are these good numbers?
These are pretty good numbers.
Okay.
And it's remarkable to me that we've never heard of them like as an Academy Award nominee, right? If you have like three great films like the Godfather trilogy,
right,
where two of them have won Best Picture, why is it that when a film is as good as Toy Story and as well written and executed as Toy Story, does it not even get like mentioned as a possible Academy Award nomination? The stuck up Hollywood types.
That I don't know, but correct me if I'm wrong. The original Toy Story is like the highest grossing animated film of all time, right? Like just in terms of you know, re-releases, home video releases, like total amount of money that an animated film has ever made. The original Toy Story is the biggest animated film of all time, right?
I think you're right. I think you're right. Have you seen, by the way, the Pixar story on Netflix or, I mean, or wherever you see it, but it's a documentary?
No.
Like the history of Pixar. I think you would find it fascinating. I'm sure that a lot of our audience probably would as well. And, I mean, that was such a contentious time, the Toy Story, because that was their first feature-length film, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically, like, Steve Jobs came in and became, like, the biggest shareholder investor, like, saw what these guys were doing. When even George Lucas had turned them down, mm-hmm. like, Steve Jobs had met with him. He's like, no, these guys are amazing. I'm going to fork over a lot of money. So he became, like, one of the top shareholders. That's why he then became one of the top shareholders in Disney when they bought, you know, Pixar is when Disney finally bought Pixar.
Yeah. To be fair, sometime after Return of the Jedi, but before The Phantom Menace, George Lucas lost it.
I don't know what he – I guess the thing that they point out in the movie, and I think – and George Lucas is even in the movie, mm-hmm. is that he – you know, he's like, I just didn't know what to do with these guys. Mm-hmm. That he ended up, though, having to create his own version of what Pixar was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of the stuff that he was doing with the Clone Wars mm-hmm. and all of the other animated stuff that, and CGI stuff that he ended up building later came as a result of what he could have had with the folks from Pixar, like if he mm-hmm. had actually used them instead of had to build his own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it went on to gross over $361 million worldwide.
That's a lot of money, Clayton. Let me tell you why. I was being kind of facetious, but I was trying to arrive at something as well when I made that remark about Rotten Tomatoes and percentages, and here's why. I was recently talking to a longtime friend of the program here and a friend of ours, apart from the program now as well, Stan Bush, who, of course, is best known for his songs in the Transformers movie from the 80s, The Touch and Dare. And he's working on a new album. In fact, he just put a new single out. The people from High Moon Studios, the video game company, remixed The Touch for their recent release, Transformers Fall of Cybertron, which is a multi-platform video game that's out right now. And apparently is, like, super awesome. And anyway, so they remixed The Touch for use in the video game, and that was just released. And he and I happen to be talking about this new album that he's working on that's going to be out next year and some other things relating to – this is very, very interesting to me. And since we're probably going to end up talking quite a bit of music today, here's my awkward seg into that. I'm going to ask you this. I'm curious how much of this you may already know. Did you know that if I wanted to, for example, like if I wanted to make a cover version, if I wanted to cover The Touch by Stan Bush, that I don't need his permission to do it?
Really?
This is true.
I did know. So you're able to do it and then ask, like, post. You're able to ask for his permission after you do it or something?
Essentially, yes. He cannot deny me the ability to do it under U.S. copyright law. This is called a compulsory license. Here's the trick of it. If you do it in advance with the artist's permission, it is far more likely that they'll negotiate a favorable royalty rate, which you must pay under U.S. law. But even if they say, no, you can't, like, no, you can't cover my song, you can do it anyway. You are entitled to a compulsory license as an American. However, if they're opposed to you doing it, when the time comes to negotiate the royalty that you must pay for doing it, then you have some trouble. And this is what I thought was crazy. We were talking about this, and I was looking at this on, you know, like the major music publisher licensing groups like BMI and ASCAP, which are like the two predominant ones. Legally, you can be stuck paying a royalty up to 200% per instance of that. So just to clarify what that means, if you sell the song for 99 cents in iTunes, right? They could, if they wanted to negotiate an unfavorable rate because they don't like you or whatever, you could pay them $1.98 for every 99 cent song that you release. 200% is the U.S. legal max.
So they could come to you. If I create a Stan Bush The Touch, mm-hmm. you and I are going to do it Edgar Oliver Rice and the Pistachios style. Me on keyboard.
Right. Me on washboard.
Right. We release this thing to iTunes. We sell like 7 of them because Grizz folks want to hear it, right?
Oh my God! Do they ever?
Then his recording company could come back and say, "Hey, you have to pay a royalty."
You're obligated to pay the royalty. The trick is, how do the negotiations of that rate go? Because if you have a positive and a favorable relationship with them, like you go to them in advance and you're respectful and you're asking for their permission to do it, they might negotiate something favorable. Like they might say, oh, we just want 10% of what you make. On the other hand, if they don't like you, maybe you go ahead and do it without their knowledge. Although, to be fair, to satisfy the compulsory license, you do have to send them something by certified mail advising them that you intend to do it. They don't have to respond, though. But let's say for whatever reason they hate it, or they don't like what you're doing with it, or they just don't like you. They could up to 200%. Up to 200%. I heard a knock at the door, and I think Clayton's gone.
No, so I'm just going to keep talking.
Oh, you are? I thought there was an assassin coming for you. So I thought that was fascinating, and they also explain, like, if you go on the BMI website, for example, and you're looking for, like, you just Google, how do I pay music royalties, the first thing that's going to come up is this handbook that BMI has made where they talk about how they want to make it as easy as possible for you to do it, and it has got to be some of the most complicated crap I've ever read in my entire life. Like, how you notify the band members, how you notify the people that wrote it, how you notify the publisher, what you have to pay to each of them, that each of these people can't be entitled to this. The total amount of money that you're going to pay can never exceed 200% of, you know, like, it's unbelievable. And I find that kind of stuff fascinating. I know people have heard us talk about this kind of stuff, like the logistics of the music biz and things like that, but I never knew any of that before.
Yeah, I had no idea. So when you have a really successful cover song, you know, then you're really not reaping the rewards as much as perhaps you think you are, unless you have a good relationship with the folks.
Right, yeah, you really do. You need to, you know, cultivate a really positive relationship with the person who owns the copyright, I guess, or the original artist. Otherwise, you could actually just end up losing massive amounts of money for doing it. And that's, I would guess, that must be why, like, people who do that, they use a compulsory license where they don't need to seek the artist's permission. And then, you know, their lawyer has to contact one of these major licensing companies like BMI or ASCAP, who have to get, you know, they actually deal with the individual artist then. You think about all the fees that are involved in doing all of this kind of stuff. And then what if they come back to you and you've already got your single out in iTunes and they say, yeah, we want the full 200%.
I wonder if that's, like, happened.
I'm sure. I mean, that I'm sure it has. But I would guess, in that instance, a lot of people are just like, well, I guess we'll just delete, you know, pull the single, you know, or delete it or from the catalog, etc. But yeah, I was mystified by that whole thought process. And then when I looked it up online, I was like, this is the craziest and most convoluted and, like, kind of archaic system of doing these kinds of things. But and I always kind of think of, like, you know, those movie soundtracks where you know, it's like some unknown artist covering a much more famous song, like, because they probably didn't want to have to pay for the license or the sync license to use the original. Like, what a pain in the butt that must be to go that route. Like, I think you'd almost just pay and get the original. Like,
right.
Who cares?
So to clear this up, yes, Toy Story went on to earn over $361 million worldwide. reviews were generally positive, praising it both the technical innovation and animation and the wit and the sophistication of the screenplay. It's now widely considered by many critics to be one of the best animated films of all time. Toy Story 2, I really love. Actually, I liked all three of them. I mean, they're all excellent. But Toy Story 2 had a place for me, and I think you would probably appreciate Toy Story 2 a lot from a toy collector perspective. Mm-hmm. Because the nemesis in Toy Story 2 is a toy collector who goes to great lengths to, like, you know, clean up Woody, get him, like, ready for sale. He's got a complete set now of the Roundup gang, you know, like in the first film, you have no idea that Woody's, like, part of a collection. You know,
But that part of it is what I've seen. Like, the part where the guy steals him from the garage sale and takes him home and he meets the rest of the set.
Right.
That's the part of it I've seen.
So it is pretty funny. And there's a toy fixer guy that he brings in to, like, fix his arm, to clean him up, to buff it, you know, to put, like paint on his nose and stuff. And it just reminded me, the nemesis guy reminded me of Chick. Whom you and I have talked about on this show a number of times. Of course, Chick being the – how would you describe him?
Well, he was the proprietor of a trading card, like mostly sports card, but all kinds of trading card shops that was located upstairs from Pagoda Comics, which was like a dirty alternative to the more favorable Golden Eagle Comics, in our hometown of West Lawn, Pennsylvania. He was surly, gross, overweight, and among these qualities that is worthy to mention, he is also deceased.
Right. all he ate, and we've mentioned this on the show before, all he ate, I think he lived in the back of the store. Mm-hmm. All he ate were like Hot Pockets in a microwave that he had set up in the store.
Yep.
He was morbidly obese. He would steal from the kids. So, and how did he steal from the kids? Well, he would put out the new pack of cards, and he would melt. He would like,
he'd open the packs, remove the cards that had value, stock it up with just the commons, which are, you know, all but worthless, and then reseal the pack using wax.
This guy, I mean, and it's brilliant that the guy who, the voice actor who plays him in Toy Story 2 is the guy, of course, who played Newman on Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. So he plays the – why can't I think of his name? You know who he is, right?
Wayne Knight?
Wayne Knight. Very good. Very good. Yeah, he does the voice actor in Toy Story 2 for the Chick character, the proprietor.
I was going to say he could also voice Chick if they ever made like an animated version of him.
So anyway, well, we should pause here. And thank one of our great show sponsors, the brand new Squarespace.
Mm.
The folks over at Squarespace have been doing some great things. And, you know, a lot of people are asking us on Twitter, like, hey, you know, is Squarespace that good? Because I've been thinking about doing a Squarespace for a while now. And yes, it is. In fact, as you had mentioned on a previous show, I built my photography website over on Squarespace. And this month, folks, we are moving grizzlyproductions.tv over to Squarespace. So we're very excited about that. And we wouldn't do it if we didn't believe in it. We absolutely love them. And so, yes, they are fantastic. So if you're thinking about doing it, you definitely want to start to look into doing it, because just go to squarespace.com. And that's the place to do it. And you can watch a little promo video over there, right?
Right. If you're going over there, by the way, if you're going to take the time to go to squarespace.com, go to squarespace.com/grizzly when you go over there, because we want them to know you came from us.
That's right. So Chad Ingles writing here on Twitter saying, to heck with WordPress, check out Squarespace. Go over to squarespace.com/grizzly so we get credit for you just coming to look around. It's free to look around. It's free to even sign up. You don't need a credit card for like 14 days. So you can try it out. You can pick from a whole host of different templates to try.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so great about giving them a try is it's all drag and drop. So you don't need to know anything about code. So if you have a small business, in fact, we were looking at some different businesses. Like my sister, she's an artist, and so she does all sorts of interesting things. We were looking at some different websites up in her town that she lives up in Connecticut now, for some similar businesses. And they're terrible websites these people have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're like written with like Comic Sans font. they look like they're built on – I don't even know what they're using. But if you want your business to be taken seriously – you've got to use Squarespace. The drag and drop capability. When I say drag and drop, what do I mean? I mean, you put in a picture, you can literally grab it, and you can move it around to a portion of your page. You can also then write a whole bunch of text, you know, let them know about your business or your service, whatever it is. And then you don't like where it's positioned on the page, you just grab that block of text and you can slide it to the right, slide it to the left. I'm telling you, go over to squarespace.com/grizzly and watch the promo video. You'll really get a sense of how it all works.
That's right. And if you want to save a lot of money, and you know this too, business owners, to hire a developer and a designer, because oftentimes you need both to overhaul a website or create one from scratch for you, that you can be talking about an investment of thousands and thousands of dollars. And this here, not only are they going to allow you to play with it for free for 14 days to see if it's something you can make work, get a load of this. If you use the special promotional code that we're about to give you, they'll give you 10% off the subscription of your website for the life of the site. As long as you keep it, they'll give you 10% off the subscription rate. When you use this one is really important and it's near and dear to my heart. I want you to use promotional code BARB, B-A-R-B. And here's how you're going to remember it. It's as if you've shortened barbarian to barb, one syllable.
Barb. And you may remember that from a few episodes ago where Mike was describing his time with the barbarian. down there in King of Trios.
We went miniature golfing together. Listen, you know, if you've gone out there, even if you get something designed and built for you, the real trick of these types of sites is maintenance. And because this has such a great responsive design, it immediately adjusts itself when it's being looked at on a mobile device versus a computer monitor, and because it allows you to constantly update the way it integrates with your social media. So let's say you started this business and 2 months from now you decide to start doing a Twitter campaign as well. You can hook this instantly to your Twitter account. You don't have to call up your design team. You don't have to get another bill for the hours that they spend doing it. Because they've simplified it and made it so that you don't need to know any code to make it work, you can do it all yourself. The savings, if you are a small business owner, that this represents to you is immense. So go right now to squarespace.com/grizzly. Check it out. Try it. And if you're going to run with it, hey, you might as well save that 10%. So use promotional code BARB. And if you wonder how we got that, it's as if we shortened barbarian to one syllable.
That's the brilliance of Mike and I. There you go. Mm. Squarespace.com/grizzly. Hey, we wouldn't be able to do the show without them, so please just go there and support them.
Yeah!
And check them out. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate it. So yeah, we were listening to some different records this week, and it's kind of fun. We were we both got David Byrne's new album.
Yeah!
And we both picked up the new Pet Shop Boys album as well.
That's right. Now, I haven't listened to the Pet Shop Boys, but I have already listened to the David Byrne St. Vincent album in its entirety. And more than once. I listened to it two times the whole way through. Have you listened to that one?
I have. I have indeed. I've listened to it two or three times all the way through.
Mm-hmm. When I had first emailed you about it, I felt like right from the beginning, it really evoked like the current sound of They Might Be Giants. Like the horns and everything else. Like, it was as if They Might Be Giants were backing up David Byrne.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. Without the music, or without the lyrics up front.
Mm-hmm. And I really like St. Vincent's voice. I think she complements him really well.
Yeah, she's not she's atypical sounding female, right? She has mm-hmm. a little bit of that. Let me just say, I don't know that she has a Natalie Merchant flair to her.
Mm-hmm.
In that. Not that she sounds like Natalie Merchant, but that she pairs well with David Byrne in some sort of off-kilter kind of way. I can't explain mm-hmm. what it is.
Right. Well, her voice is very, like, calming.
Right.
And his voice is not, you know? Like, his voice is like a panic attack happening. So.
Right, but it's calm. But her voice is calming in a, I don't know, kind of an eclectic kind of way. You know, I wouldn't hold her up there with, like, a Jane Monheit. In that way. I just, when I heard her for the first time, I thought, these guys go well together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like peanut butter and jelly. So she is formerly, her name is Annie Clark. She's formerly mm-hmm. of a Polyphonic Spree, which I'd never heard of before.
Right.
And I like this. This is actually a good description of her, a nonconformist, a brilliant mm-hmm. nonconformist. It's mm-hmm. a good way to describe her. So take me through it, because I really enjoyed... There are a couple that really stand out to me, but I'm curious how you felt about them.
Yeah, I really, really like this album, and I think they made a good choice. The lead single from this is the first track. It's called Who, and I think that's the best track on the album. I think they really made a smart choice there. One of the things we've certainly talked about this a lot over the course of these nearly 200 episodes of The Grizz now is like there's nothing more annoying than when you get an album and like they pick the worst song on there to be the single. Like, what? Who came up with that idea? So I really do like that. And then they alternate. For the 12 tracks on here, they alternate vocal leads. So Byrne will sing a song, Clark will sing a song, Byrne sings, Clark sings, etc. Although they both do sing together on the first track, Who. I really, really do like the way that it kind of alternates like that because some of Byrne's more recent stuff, and this is what I had remarked to you, Clayton, although the chronology in my brain is a little bit off. The last really great David Byrne solo album, in my opinion, is Look Into the Eyeball from 2001. I thought that was from 99, but it's not. I felt like he had a really strong streak there for a while. He had Hey Momo, Uh-Oh, the David Byrne eponymous album, which we talked about very recently, Feelings, which was and Look Into the Eyeball, which almost seemed like a return to form. And then he had a couple that were really not so good, in my opinion. Grown Backwards came out in 2004. And on this, like, it's very political. It's him, like, on a couple tracks, he's singing opera. Like, what? What are you doing? You know,
right.
I just wanted to, like, I wanted to confront him about it. I don't know where I would find him. But I'd be like, David Byrne, like, I know he lives in Soho somewhere, but that's a pretty big geographical region. And I'd just be like, what are you doing? And then, you know, just a couple years ago, he teamed up again with Brian Eno, who, you know, had produced some of the most famous Talking Heads albums, including Remain in Light. That's, I think that one's generally considered, like, the height of their collaboration. And that contains Once in a Lifetime, which you could maybe make the argument's the most identifiable Talking Heads song. I think people might argue that it's Burning Down the House or that it's Take Me to the River or maybe even Psycho Killer. But I happen to think Once in a Lifetime is the most identifiable Talking Heads song. I almost said They Might Be Giants there. So he and Brian Eno, about 4 years ago, put out Everything That Happens Will Happen Today, which to me is an album that's about one song, Strange Overtones.
Right.
And the rest of that album doesn't need to exist.
No, that song can stand alone. And it sounds nothing like the rest of the album. It's funny, when I go in, you know, when I go into my iTunes to listen to that record, I mean, I scroll through it, go right to Strange Overtones. I don't even look or play any of the other songs in that album.
Yeah. And, like, you know, when he was out doing media for that, he was on the Colbert Report, I think twice, promoting that. He did all these media appearances. He never played Strange Overtones. Like, he always played one of the other songs. And that's always baffling to me, like the choices that he makes as it relates to that. And so I feel like in the last 10 years, he really hasn't – also worthy of note here is that Here Lies Love double disc concept collaboration that he did with Fatboy Slim. That's really the most recent thing to bear his name that came out. And that was okay. But David Byrne only sings on one track. There's like 30-some tracks on that album. David Byrne only sings on one. Annie Clark, actually, of St. Vincent, does sing one of those. That's probably where they first worked together. So this, to me, is really more of like a straightforward kind of thing, other than the fact that, you know, he shares vocal duties with Clark from St. Vincent. So overall, I really like this. It's quirky like a David Byrne album should be. I don't feel like he's trying to hit me over the head with his political ramblings like he was on Grown Backwards. She offers a nice counterpoint to his voice, as you pointed out. And it's just got, like, I don't know if it's because of the horns or what it is, but his last couple, especially Grown Backwards, which, like I said, you know, has all kinds of awful experimentation on, and Everything That Happens Will Happen Today, the Brian Eno one, which is exceptionally electronic in sounding. This one's just, like, alive. It's got, like, a vibrancy to it that the other ones have lacked.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I've been looking for something from David Byrne that sort of brought some of his energy back.
Yeah.
Some of the energy that we grew to love about him had been missing from some of his more recent albums, and where he's gone off into some weird electronica stuff, which is fine. You know, he's always been an experimental guy, but when it lacks that sort of enthusiasm throughout the record, then there's nothing there to keep me around, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these experimental music lovers that I can, like, yeah, man, you got to just get into it, man. You just got to get into it and listen to it. No, like, if I don't have, like, a visceral reaction to it, I'm never going to listen to it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's like My Life in the Bush of Ghosts,
mm-hmm.
right? That record from – when was that?
Maybe. Right. Wow. 81?
Yeah.
Well, let me go back and look here. That's a really good one. Yes, it is. My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which was a collaboration with Eno again, 1981, where they just, like, remixed all these weird electronic sounds, like snippets of, like, a preacher rambling that they looped until it became almost incomprehensible. Right. It's like a strange – My Life in the Bush of Ghosts to me is almost like the perfect example of, like, a vanity project.
Right.
Like, what is this? You know? And it really isn't. And I agree with you. My Life in the Bush of Ghosts is the kind of thing you listen to it once, and then it will collect dust for the rest of your life.
Right. True. That's exactly what it does. All it does is collect dust and occasionally serves as a coaster for me.
Yeah. And you know they remastered that and, like, added tracks, like, for the 20th anniversary, 25th anniversary, whatever that was a couple years ago, like – though, you know, because someone demanded it. No, like Brian Eno demanded it. It was remastered with 4 hours of bonus tech crap. Like, oh, why? And I kept thinking, too, you know, when it passed not all that long ago, the anniversary of the release of Hey Momo, like, oh, it'd be awesome if he did, like, a tour where maybe he played the album in its entirety or, you know, like an expanded version with deleted tracks came out. No, we don't get that for Hey Momo, which I think is, you know, like this landmark album in music. But we did for My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Speaking of big collaborations, well, we'll tell you about The Dark Knight the big box set that's coming out. We'll tell you about that in a little bit. But I thought maybe we should play a song here from this. Why don't you, should we play Who?
Yes, I think so. You know, they put that out there for free so people could listen to it and stuff. Obviously, they want that to capture your attention and imagination. So I think we're pretty safe if we want to play some of that.
Yeah, so we'll play like 30 seconds of the song Who off of the collaboration between St. Vincent and David Byrne. The album is called Love This Giant, and it's pretty darn good. Take a listen.
I like it.
Yeah. So the other album that, because you and I said we were going to pick up some new albums, I picked up Elysium, which is the brand new record from Pet Shop Boys.
Mm-hmm.
These guys have been doing some great stuff in their later years and probably to not a lot of fanfare. However, they did bring down the house at the Olympics. They were part of the closing ceremony and people were blown away by their performance. In London, live at the big closing ceremonies there. And a lot of people said, wow, what have these guys been up to? Well, they've been up to a new album that just came out on September 11th called Elysium. And this album, you know, took a little – I have to say it brought me in immediately. And again, this comes back to that first song, a song called Leaving, which I actually heard when I was over in Germany with the family for the first time. And I said, what is this? This is Pet Shop Boys, but I've never heard this song before. But it sounded like something out of the 80s from them.
Right, because their sound really hasn't modernized much.
Right, and that's great, you know?
Yes.
I don't need them switching things up. They're the Pet Shop Boys. And I loved it. And I made a mental note of the song. The song was called Leaving, and it is the lead song off their new album. So, again, another album that comes right out with a great song and ropes you in. And I had to say, and I don't know what my remarks to you were when I was texting you about it. It just has this very ethereal feeling to this whole album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those you can put on in the background while you're doing some work and you know, really takes hold. Some of them, you know, some of the songs are better than others, but some of them really stand out, like, you know, it could be stuck on one of your favorite 80s records from the Pet Shop Boys.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they kind of stay true to their electronic roots in here. You have this like deep electronic sound and a lot of these really beautiful sort of orchestral arrangements in this. And that's what I mean. You can put it on the background while you're doing some work. You won't find it, you won't find it disconcerting while you're getting some work done. Mm-hmm. But you'll hear a lot of like It's a Sin in this album. Not too much West End Girls, but I feel like It's a Sin would fit in perfectly on this record.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty excited about it. I'm actually excited that they – because there was an album a few years ago that you and I got when I lived back in West Virginia, that orange-covered one that had Home and Dry on it.
Right, right.
Yeah. So they've been doing some good stuff in their later years. It has 12 new songs and there's no sort of covers or reworkings of what they've been doing, but they're on top of their game here. And it's the same group, right? They've had
it's just those two dudes.
Yeah,
it's just Neil Tennant and the other guy.
And they brought in some nice backing singers too.
Mm-hmm.
Oren, Maxine, and Julie Waters, who has sung with the Jackson 5, and Adele most recently. Speaking of Adele, Adele just got the song. She's doing the Bond song for the new Bond film, Skyfall.
I thought she retired or something. Wasn't she leaving to go and have kids? Like, I'm not going to make music anymore.
Maybe, but I guess just one song probably wouldn't take that much out of you.
Mm.
But it's not like you're not going to hear this album in like a dance club anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I don't need it to. So it has a very a quiet approach. So anyway, I thought I'd play a little song. Have you heard the song Leaving yet?
No, I haven't heard any of it yet. So go ahead. I trust your good judgment here to pick a good excerpt.
Okay, here's Leaving from the Pet Shop Boys off their new album, Elysium.
I know when I'm still a friend, you're leaving. You've had a lot of time to decide on your freedom, but I can still find some hope to believe. Our love is dead.
know that Neil Tennant is often like criticized and jabbed at by Morrissey. He likes to take his pot shots at him, and I thought it was very interesting. Just a few years ago, when the Pet Shop Boys were inducted into the British Music Hall of Fame at one of their award ceremonies, which is called BAMFAMET, is the acronym. I love that. I can't even remember who it was that was inducting him. If it was Tom Jones or it was somebody like that, just spent like his whole speech slamming Morrissey. Basically, and I really like Morrissey as well, but I love the fact that Morrissey just wants to have an argument with everybody. Like, I love that about him. You know, the fact that he's like forever cantankerous and disagreeable. Right. Like, that's how I want my Morrissey. I want him to be that way. Like, I've often I know there are probably two camps of people, right? In that among those who really do worship Morrissey, they hope to have like this one moment of like sincere interaction with him. But to me, I think the best interaction you could ever have as a Morrissey fan is like he insults you, you know, like he just dismisses you, like has his security get rid of you. I think that's how interaction with Morrissey should always go.
And that's how would want it. Like if you ever had a chance to meet him, you would hope that he would put you down.
Right. Like, that's come on. Like, that's what he's all about. I want to tell you a couple quick things related to something we talked about in this episode and something we haven't talked about in a few episodes. As an addendum to the David Byrne talk, David Byrne's new book is coming out very soon. It's called How Music Works. It'll be out before the end of the year. And it is about just in general his experience making music, about the way that time and place changes perception of music, and it's somewhat about the music business. That is forthcoming from David Byrne. He has written quite a few books in recent years. And Telegraph Avenue, which we discussed a few episodes ago, from the man who we sometimes erroneously pronounce as Michael Chabon, is out now.
Right.
So if you wanted to go and get Telegraph Avenue, go and check that out. I've been reading in very, very small chunks Malcolm Gladwell's What the Dog Saw, which was loaned to me by a friend. I'm making slow progress through that. And that's been very, very good.
What is the premise of that book?
It's just a collection of essays. Yes, exactly. It's like stuff of his, I would say, between the late 90s and early 2000s that was published in various magazines or other, you know, publications, things like that. So it's all over the place. It's really all over the place. But that's kind of what makes it enjoyable, I think. And I also want to lay this at your feet. And we'll talk about this more, not on this episode, but in the future. I was recently made aware of a subgenre of pop music called sophistopop. Have you ever heard that expression before?
No, but you know my hatred of these new subgroups of music, right, and all these labels. But here we go again.
This kind of harkens back to a discussion you and I had on Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe number one, where we talked about pub rock. I had never heard this term before, sophistopop. And I'll tell you how I stumbled across it. There is an 80s one-hit wonder band called Double, or as they were actually supposed to be pronounced, Double. But I always thought they were called Double. I pronounced it because I'm an American. They're actually from Zurich, Switzerland, and it's supposed to be pronounced Double. And they are best known for their mid-80s one-off hit, The Captain of Her Heart.
Oh, yeah. I love that song.
Right. You would definitely know it if you heard it, even if, for me to speak, the title doesn't trigger anything in your memory. And, you know, every once and again, I like to seek out bizarre trivia about these people. I'm like, I wonder if they ever did anything else. Like, you know, what else were they up to? And so I was digging around looking for their stuff and found that their best known album, which is Blue, that's the one that contains that song, is considered like an excellent example of sophistopop, which, I'd never heard before. So I Googled this up. And the first thing I came across said that the chief purveyors of this subgenre, sophistopop, are Simply Red, Sharday, and Swing Out Sister, which is a unique collection of artists in that those are all artists that I happen to have all the albums of. And I thought, well, here I'm a fan of this. I didn't even know it existed.
Right. So what is the classification, though? Like what makes it different, especially since they're old?
Right. Right?
It's like they went back and they relabeled They Might Be Giants ska.
Yeah, it's definitely some kind of retroactive labeling of these artists that made like more sophisticated pop music in the 80s. They all are from the 80s. And so I found a list online of maybe like 30 artists from Johnny Hates Jazz to ABC to Scritti Politti to, you know, whatever, all these artists that made up sophistopop. And I have stuff by virtually all of them except for a handful. And that handful included these. The Style Council. Are you familiar with the Style Council?
No. Let me look them up. Do they have a song that I'd know?
You might know their song, My Ever-Changing Moods. Like, to hear the title of it, I was like, huh? But then I listened to it, and I was like, I do know that. That was one of them. And now, forgive me, I don't think I'm going to pronounce her name correctly. Beja?
Beja.
Basia?
Beja.
Is it Beja?
Yeah, in fact, if you'll recall.
Didn't we play her as like a guilty pleasure eons ago?
Yeah, she was one of my guilty pleasure songs.
Right. She is considered one of them. And I looked up her greatest hits, and I actually knew three or four of those songs. Yeah. I was amazed.
Yeah, I'm a fan. In fact, I have one of their albums. I guess it's not really her, right? I mean, it's...
Right. It's like Sade. Like, it refers to the band at large, even though it's just her name.
Right.
Yeah. She's a Polish vocalist who had a slew of hits in Europe, but three of them made it big here in the U.S.
Yeah. Trying to find out. Yeah, she has a bunch. I mean,
yeah, the ones you would know are Only Time Will Tell, Time and Tide, and Cruising for Bruising.
Right, I played Cruising for Bruising on my. It's one of my guilty pleasure songs.
Yeah. So as I'm digging around, looking at this kind of stuff, and it's always interesting to me, right? Like, I've discovered this subgenre that contains about 30 artists, and 27 of them I already am familiar with and are fans of. So it would lead me to think I'll probably like these other three, right? That seems like a reasonable deduction. So I'm looking further into things here, discovering this, and I stumbled across, not exactly in this genre, but something I had never, ever, ever heard of before. An album by a group called The Blue Nile, entitled Hats.
Now, it's just funny you say that, because as I was typing in the Style Council here on Amazon, I saw The Blue Nile as a suggestion.
Right. So as I'm looking at all of these different artists, that album keeps coming up.
Hats.
Right. It's always like suggested, or people who bought this also bought that, or we think you might also like. That album comes up under all of the Sophistopop artists I looked at.
There's only 7 songs on this album.
Yes. And I'm not going to tell you anything more about it. Here's kind of what I want you to do. Take a few minutes and see what you can discover about this act. I was blown away reading the reviews I found online from this album. You would think that this must be the most important album of the 1980s, and I've never heard about it before this weekend.
I see 5-star reviews through the whole thing. Perfect, timeless, so undeserving of the moniker New Wave. A classic that still stands out. Another outstanding release from an astonishing duo. I've never heard of these guys.
Me neither. So this will be discussed in grander detail, perhaps, when we get together to create the 200th Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. And it's fitting in a weird way, right? We discovered pub rock back when we launched this, and we're discovering Sophistopop. Maybe we'll make the effort to listen to the Blue Nile's seminal work, Hats. Apparently they take 7 to 10 years off between albums, so there aren't a lot to research. And we will discuss that, among other topics, on the monumental 200th Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Are you up for this?
I am up for that. And it's that particular episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe is going to be brought to you. They're going to be celebrating with us because they've been here the longest, and they're going to be celebrating us with us on the 200th episode. That is our fantastic show sponsor, the folks over at Cobra, folks at Cobra Electronics. So they are going to be giving away, because they've loved all that you've done for them over the years, and they're going to be giving us a bunch of stuff away on next week's episode, to thank our listeners and to thank us for our 200th episode. It's going to be exciting. So we're going to attempt to do a live show, our first ever live Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Now, we may or may not bring in some folks from the outside, but basically it's going to be live. We will tweet out. So what time? Are we going to do this at the same time we always do it?
That's fine. That's fine with me.
Yeah. So we will attempt to do it same bat time. So that'll be what, October 9th, roughly?
Yes, yeah. That seems correct.
October 9th at about 11 a.m. Eastern time. So we will send out a tweet from our Grizzly Bear Cafe Twitter account when the show is about to be live, and we hope that many of you will join us and watch it live, or listen live. You can just listen to the audio, I'm sure. But we will do this live show. It'll be so exciting, and our thanks to Cobra. And they make some great things, don't they, my friend?
Indeed they do. They make all kinds of awesome gadgets that simplify your life. And as the holidays are rolling near, you could pick one up for yourself, And because they offer all kinds of awesome specials on their website, like buy one, get one free, you could keep one for yourself. What do you think about that? The specials that they offer on their website, which is Cobra.com, change quite frequently. So you're going to want to head over there right now on that left-hand navigation and see what kind of specials they're offering. They include deep discounts. And like I said, they often have buy one, get one free offers. They did for quite a while on their Cobra tag system, which is the perfect gift idea for the person you know who's always misplacing their stuff. If they can't find their keys, they misplace their laptop bag, their briefcase, their dog, whatever the case might be. The Cobra tag is the perfect solution because it pairs with your smartphone and works as a two-way locator. So if I've put the fob of the Cobra tag on my keychain and I lose my keys, I can call it from my phone. And if I'm so far out of range that I can't hear it ringing, the app will draw me a map to where I misplaced the item. That is quite remarkable. And if in reverse, if I misplace my smartphone but I have the Cobra tag that's on my keychain, I can call my phone from that. It works in reverse. This is just one of the amazing and ingenious innovations that you're going to find over at Cobra.com, and they are made for people on the go. That's why I love them. That's why Clayton loves them, and we think you're going to love them too. So pay a visit to our great and long-standing show sponsors over at Cobra.com. We could not deliver this podcast and others like it, like, for example, Daddy on Board, where you'll find me every Friday, without the help of them. They make this program and others like it possible.
Indeed they do. Mm-hmm. So, what else is going on? Now, you have a big – I caught wind of this, right? You have a big webinar coming up very soon, don't you?
Oh.
As busy as you are. So, now, I mean, for those of our listeners who don't know, I mean, you've run or helped run a school for a very long time.
I have.
Chikara Pro.
Well, the school's Chikara Wrestle Factory, and right. It sort of begat this wrestling company called Chikara. Which is my home base in the wild and woolly world of professional wrestling. And I've had the opportunity over the years, I've gone all over the planet teaching seminars. What I've come to discover is, I might show up and, there's 30 people here, but I was under the impression there were going to be 36. And somebody will say, this car couldn't make it for some reason. Or, these people were there too far away, or the time disagreed with them, or something happened and they couldn't make it. But the next time you come, the next time you're going to be in Switzerland, they'll be here.
Right.
I'm not in Switzerland every weekend. So this webinar provides an interesting alternative to that, in that it's available worldwide. It'll be a live event streaming out for 2 hours worldwide. And it is a little different from what I typically offer if you've come to one of my seminars in the past. And it differs in this way. I think back to when I was first getting my start in the pro wrestling business. And when I was new to everything, I really felt like, in terms of my priorities, like, what do I really need to know? What I probably need to know is, like, what's the most recently invented super cool move? Can I learn it and master it? And then I'll be the guy that does that. And unfortunately, the shelf life of that type of thing can be quite short. I wish that earlier on in my career I had come to understand things like coming up with a marketable persona for myself that is attractive to people that will hire me. Those kinds of things would have been really important early on in my career. And especially today, the ability to use, whether it's social media or other resources that are available out there for you for free to help increase your visibility in the market space, how to go about that intelligently and professionally within our medium is really important advice. And I can tell you this because I'm constantly hearing from people that know that I run Chikara Wrestle Factory, where I'm the head trainer, and they say, hey, could you take a look at this thing that I do? Or, hey, can you help me craft this resume so it might get me noticed here, or that kind of thing? I get asked those types of questions all the time. And it can be very difficult in the course of like a one-minute conversation to really explain to people the most effective way to go out and reach the people that can hire you.
And so when you would do one of these big seminars around the world and you go there and you have like 30 people there, I mean, how much would something like that cost? I mean, it would cost like a couple $100 to come see you in that kind of capacity, or?
Well, it certainly varies by the marketplace. I've done seminars that are as high as $100 a head. But the reason that one of the things that's great about this webinar is you're not going to have to get in your car. You're not going to have to spend a dime on gas. You're not going to have to pay a toll. You're not going to have to buy a plane ticket to come and see me or put yourself up in a hotel the night before so you can be there when we start. None of those things are going to be true about this thing. You're going to sit down in front of your computer, or I guess you could maybe even watch it on a mobile device. Some of the tech's a little bit over my head. I leave that to people more informed than yours truly in that regard. But I'm coming right into your home with this type of stuff. And especially for people in the pro wrestling industry that are looking to expand their horizons, this is the kind of thing for you. Now, if what you're doing within the pro wrestling industry, and this webinar of mine is really quite specific to the industry where I work, if you are completely content with everything that you have and you're not aspiring to anything larger, this is not for you. But if you are looking for ways to perhaps achieve a more or to better identify the most marketable version of your in-ring persona so that you have greater opportunities presented to you as you grow as a performer, then The Power of You on Sunday, October 21st, streaming out live that afternoon, is a two-hour webinar you cannot afford to miss. Go to chikarapro.com and you'll see my face right there on the front page. Click on that for more information about this webinar.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, there are people who I've been there when there are people who've come up to you to ask questions, and you're pulled in all sorts of directions. You don't have a chance to respond in or be involved, you know, that closely with someone. So to be able to actually, you know, work with individuals on a one-to-one basis like that, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And webinars are
changing forward to it.
And webinars are changing the way that we were able to get information. I mean, the other night I just watched a webinar on a photography course that I took. And it was great. I mean, you'd think, well, maybe I wouldn't be able to get much out of it because it's a webinar. No, I got more out of it, and it's got me more into photography than I ever thought possible. I learned more from this particular thing. So my thanks to Trey Ratcliffe for doing that great webinar. So I don't know. I love them. Then I don't have to dress up. I don't have to leave the house for them.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Yeah. You do a lot of candy photography, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean?
Candy photography.
Mm-hmm.
So what else is going on? Hey, did you see this Captain America news?
Well, I thought you were going to tell me Dark Knight news.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got that too. So we got Dark Knight news. I got Captain America news. And all of this, we tweet out a lot of great stuff on our Grizzly Bear Cafe Twitter account throughout the week. So you can get some great comic book news and things that we find grizz-worthy here, stuff we may or may not talk about, but stuff we definitely think is worthy of discussion. Captain America, the actor who is playing the Falcon.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think this has actually been confirmed by any real source, but, that's certainly the front runner, I guess, is what you'd want to say for the role of the Falcon, which is super cool because the Falcon's one of my favorites.
Well, I don't know about that. So for everything I've been reading is that he is playing the Falcon, Anthony Mackie.
Okay.
He's starring in the Cap sequel as the Falcon. He's admitted he's super excited about the role. He's very proud to take on the iconic role. Mm-hmm. And he says that he has not yet seen the Falcon costume. So he's not sure what it's going to look like yet, but he's super excited to see it. That is
cool.
Awesome.
I think it's interesting how they kind of extend in the vocabulary of overused words. Iconic is up there with phenomenal. Is the Falcon really iconic? I don't think he is.
Well,
I love the Falcon. I don't think the Falcon's iconic.
Okay, well, perhaps. But I think in the role of African-American superheroes,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can probably count the ones that, you can probably count them on one hand, right?
Well, the Black Panther is probably the foremost up there with Luke Cage, the way they're presented by Marvel. They really present the Falcon as being a C-lister. And I like the Black Panther a lot, too. Luke Cage, that character never did anything for me. I think I'm still stuck up on his days as Power Man with that yellow shirt. It's tough for me to get over. But, I think they're both presented as being higher tiered than the Falcon. But any of those characters, you think about who the most iconic Marvel characters are, Spider-Man, the Hulk, Captain America, Iron Man, Wolverine. Those are the real icons. And it's the same at DC. If you look at their iconic characters, I mean, probably the closest, to be fair, is the John Stewart Green Lantern in terms of African-American superheroes. He's probably the most iconic.
True. I guess I just – when I think of African-American superheroes, I mean, the Falcon pops out to me right at the top of that list.
Mm-hmm.
So too does the Black Panther.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I guess as an African-American child growing up in
yes.
this country reading comic books, you might think to yourself, why aren't there more African-American characters? And, you in that community probably realize the Falcon is a lead character.
Mm-hmm.
So to be asked.
Now, of course, you grow up as an African-American reading comic books. And I'm curious, at what point did you change your mind and go white?
Well, I said, hey, there's so many better white characters out there. There's only Black Panther and the Falcon, man.
Power Man with a yellow shirt.
Speedball. Actually, I have to say Speedball was the reason I flipped.
Speedball. I love you, Speedball.
Yeah.
I am really happy that they're doing the Falcon, though. And I really, really hope that he somehow ends up in the Avengers sequel. I love the Falcon.
Yeah. What is his history? I don't know much about his history, though.
He was originally a drug dealer or like a pimp type character. You know, he's like a street level thug that was called Snap Wilson. His real name is Sam Wilson. And he ended up, you know, before he even had the wings, he was just kind of like a sidekick to Captain America. He wore this ugly green and orange costume. And then after a story that involved the Red Skull and the Cosmic Cube, and I think that might be how he has, I think it's considered like empathy with birds. Like, he doesn't talk directly to them, but I think he has, like, empathy with birds, which is not, like, a super awesome power, right? Like, that's kind of it's like a less useful version of Aquaman. But then it's the Black Panther. The Black Panther built those wings for him, which allows him to fly. And over the years, those have evolved. And his costume has evolved, too. Like, he's had some ugly ones. Like, his classic, like, 70s and 80s costume is the one I love. I love that version of the Falcon. You know, they tried to update it for a while. Like, it became like armor for a while. You remember when they did that Avengers cartoon in the 90s that was very short-lived and it had none of the major players? It was like Ant-Man, Tigra, Falcon, Vision, Wasp, Hawkeye, and Wonder Man. Like, they all had armor for no apparent reason. Like, I don't know. Like, they all had these Power Ranger-like transformations into armored-up characters. But what really made the Falcon come to life for me, because he was a bit player to me as well, was in, I want to say, 1983, give or take, Marvel produced a 4-issue limited series on the Falcon, which was written by a writer named Jim Owsley, who later changed his name to Christopher Priest. And it is he who wrote, I think, the very best interpretation of the Black Panther under the Marvel Knights imprint. And he is African-American, is Christopher Priest. And I don't know if it is for that reason. Like, he made the character seem so believable. Like, he really wrote him at a level that, like, he just came alive. I don't know if it's because he brought, like, a level of authenticity to it. I don't know. But something about the way he writes the Falcon and the Black Panther, I think, are just unparalleled. He gets those characters right when a lot of people do kind of write them as if they're afterthoughts or, you know, second stringers. And I love that Falcon limited series. It's outstanding stuff. And I'm really, really happy that that character is going to be appearing, because if I was going to make a list of the Avengers characters I want to see turn up in that universe, you know, certainly Hawkeye is on the list and Hank Pym, preferably as Yellow Jacket, although I think it's unlikely we'll get that. And then my next picks really would be like Falcon, Black Panther, and the Vision.
Hmm. Yeah, so exciting stuff. I'm glad to see that he'll be in it. It'll be interesting to see if they create him just as like a bit player or he'll have a fairly prominent role.
Don't angel him X-Men 3 style, please.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of X-Men 3, there's been quite a bit of X-Men reunion or X-Men sequel rumors. Have you heard about this?
Well, especially, you know, some of the first shots of Hugh Jackman as he's going to appear in The Wolverine have been floating out there, and I think that's really drummed up X-Men talk.
Right. So Famke Janssen has come in to say that she's not ruled out another X-Men appearance, that she might be a part of a new X-Men film. And Patrick Stewart sort of emphatically came out and said that he is going to be also – you know, he might come back for another X-Men another X-Men spot as well. So you have a couple of like the top tiered X-Men characters coming back saying they might be involved in a sequel, which I find interesting.
Yeah, now they are in pre-production already on a sequel to X-Men First Class. So if they're proceeding with that, it does kind of make you wonder, like, are they really going to pick things up, or the universe they established with X-Men X2 and X-Men 3, is that just going to kind of continue as a series of Wolverine solo films? Which is fine. I really like Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. But
yeah,
that X-Men Origins Wolverine movie was a little bleh.
Yeah. Yeah, and hopefully they'll get the Wolverine sequel a little bit better. Let's see if they can do that. Andrew Garfield, Mark Webb are coming back for Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be back. We knew that was going to happen anyway, right? Did they sign like a 3-picture deal?
Hmm.
You know how they always do that?
Yeah, I would guess, but I'm not sure.
So some of the Dark Knight news I was going to tell you about. The Blu-ray, let's see if we can find it here. The Blu-ray has been announced, and it's coming in 2013.
Mm.
Now, I thought they would have got that out by Christmas time.
Right, yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, that seemed like kind of crazy that they're going to wait till 2013 for that. I guess it really doesn't matter, right? I guess it really doesn't matter when they release it because people will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out, and there's going to be a trilogy Blu-ray box set that's coming out as well. So all of them will be in there. All three of them will be in that special box set for the Christopher Nolan series, which will be out again in 2013. So that seems a little odd, though, because when did Avengers come out?
Right, Avengers was out in May, and it's out now. You know, so 4 months turnaround for that.
I don't get it. I don't understand why, unless I'm reading that wrong. I don't know.
No, I heard the exact same thing about that. Now, that's just the trilogy. That's not to say that by itself it won't be out, The Dark Knight Rises, which you'd have to think they're putting that out in time for Christmas. I can't imagine. Whatever studio exec made that decision has probably already been fired if that's the case.
Right.
Like, do you think we should put this out for the Christmas season? No. Not this one.
Here it is. You're right about that. So the trilogy comes out, the Ultimate Collector's Edition comes out in 2013. An app for mobile devices is also on the way.
Mm-hmm.
But The Dark Knight Rises will arrive this holiday season onto Blu-ray, DVD, and digital download on December 4th. So you'll be able to get it on December 4th.
That's good.
Yeah.
People will want that.
So there you go.
Hey, we got some interesting tweets. Our friend Musical Mooster wrote to us asking this, and I can tell you right now my answer is no. Have you guys listened to the new Mark Knopfler CD Privateering? Clayton, have you?
No, I didn't even know he had a new one out.
Right.
Does he say it's any good or not?
Yeah, and Musical Mooster did not tell us that. But I guess if he hated it, he probably wouldn't have taken the time to send that to us. We also heard from a longtime member of the Egghead Army, Eric Hoff, who I believe is Eric Hofstetter, right? Am I remembering his name correctly?
Yeah.
We hear from him quite frequently. He loves Star Wars Clone Wars. He watches it with his almost 7-year-old son, and he endorses it with lots of hashtags, Clayton.
Okay, good. So I'll have to check that out then.
Yeah. Eric, you know, I'm headed your way. I'm headed your way soon. On the Neverending Chikara World Tour upcoming, I've got stops in Alabama, North Carolina, Illinois, Ohio, and New York. Am I coming to a state near you? ChikaraPro.com has information. And, of course, if you want to tweet us, you can. We're at Grizzly Bear Cafe. Just leave out the egg. You can't make a name that long in Twitter. Grizzly Bear Cafe.
That's right. Matt Mahler writes us on Twitter, says, congrats, Clayton, on the stand-up win. You definitely need to share that story on the Grizz.
This seems like a perfect time for that.
All right, I will. So, I had lamented a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks in a row, that I was nervous as hell about having to do stand-up comedy again. I reluctantly agreed to do it. My wife sort of cajoled me into it. When I got the email from them, it was to benefit the Humane Society of New York. All proceeds went to charity. And I would be performing at Comic Strip Live, which is the place where Jerry Seinfeld started. It's also the place where Chris Rock started. When you walk into this place, it's like walking into a shrine of comedy on the Upper East Side of New York City. It is remarkable. I mean, all of the sort of black pages that are up there on the wall, or the black photos that are up there on the wall with all the different comedians that have preceded you that were there, you know, everyone from Jerry Seinfeld to Steve Martin, you name it. You know, they've all gone through the comic strip, right? It's one of those definitive places. So, I didn't know that at the time. And as I was preparing to do this stand-up comedy, I had to do 5 minutes. I thought, oh, this is just going to be in some comedy club in New York somewhere or whatever. They're going to do it in some random room, you know, and the room would be packed, I'm sure, and they'll have like 6 or 7 members of the press competing. for New York's Funniest Reporter competition. And again, mm-hmm. you get up there, do 5 minutes, and all the money goes to charity. I thought, all right, I'll do this. So I had nothing written up until I flew back from Germany. And on the flight back, I finally started penning out some jokes. And I thought, well, what's funny in my life now, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that I'm a parent is hilarious. And the fact that I have kids is even more hilarious. So I thought, it's so funny because back in the day, I'd write about things that I couldn't even relate to. You know, when I was 15 and 16 doing stand-up comedy, it was about things that were much more adult than I had yet had experience to explain to people in a comedic mm-hmm. way. You know, they're like, you don't have any real-world experience. You're not going to make me laugh. Mm-hmm. But now I do. I have a little bit of experience. And so I have a little bit of experience in parenting, so that's what I did. I did a whole 5 minutes on parenting and having kids and, you know, the like, and how difficult it is, and how much more worthless I felt as a man in the delivery room. Did some bits about that, and how they try. You know, the nurses don't even try to pretend that they care about the father's comfort mm-hmm. in the delivery room. And talked a little bit about having a newborn in the house and this and that. And at the end of the night. You know, and it was great because like where I paused, like where I knew to pause and do my pauses for laughter, I had hoped mm-hmm. it actually worked and people did in fact laugh and I ended up winning. Mm. So
you'll be leaving the program now and Clayton's starting his new career as a stand-up comedian, which is actually his old career.
Right. It's come full circle again. So we raised a lot of money for charity. And it was funny because the judges then came up to me afterwards and says, you're the only one who really did stand-up comedy here. Mm. You're the only one that really did, like, you know, had presence on stage doing stand-up comedy. Like, you could tell, like, you knew, you know, your timing was great, you know, all of that. The other folks, you know, they kind of told stories about their current career and it was, you know, a lot of them talked about being reporters and that sort of thing. And I didn't mention a lick of that. You know, I didn't mm-hmm. talk about being on TV. I just talked about being a parent. You know, went right into that. So, hey, it ended up working. Now, the worst part is, though, next year I have to come back.
Mm.
And I have to do, like, 10 minutes next year mm-hmm. as, like, the headliner guy.
The headlining act.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gives you a lot of time to come up with a reason to no-show.
Right. I got a year to figure out an excuse.
Yeah.
But it was pretty incredible, though, to be in that room where – like my idol, you know, got his start. And what's even more disconcerting is you're sitting there sort of waiting to go on and you're in the, you know, back in the crowd. They had us sitting back at sort of a contestant's table up this little staircase back in the wings. And, you know, we're in the main room, but we're sitting in the back and I'm looking at – they have these TVs all around the comic strip that are – like it's just like on a loop, like old footage from like the 80s. So they've got like old footage of Jerry Seinfeld performing there. I've got old footage of Chris Rock, old footage of like all these greats, and I'm like, oh God, add more to my nerves.
Mm. Were any of those dudes funny that you mentioned?
You mean the old comedians?
Yeah, like Sari Jeinfeld.
Sari Jeinfeld, I mean, he had a sitcom. It was only on in Israel though, and if you saw it,
one of those
called "What's Up with That."
Oh, what's up with that?
So, yeah, it was
pretty
cool.
Well, congratulations and well done. So you did something good for charity, and so what's going to happen as a result of this?
Well, I think the tens of thousands of dollars they raised goes to help keep, you know, give animals a home, care for animals so they don't get euthanized, that sort of thing. So
that sounds good.
Yeah, so... You know, it's funny. I don't have any animals in the house. And when they actually asked me to pose with a dog at one point, they handed me before the show, would I mind taking a picture with this little puppy? I was like, do I have to hold it? Because, you know, I'm not a big dog person. So,
right.
It's funny, though, that I was raising money for dogs.
Mm-hmm. Did they hand you an unfed pit bull? Like, look, he's a little hungry, but just...
Just give him your hand to gnaw on.
Right.
He'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. The Mahler.
Yeah. So there you go. That was my little walk down stand-up lane.
Mm-hmm. So next year, right, you got to get – I mean, that's a really long block of time, 10 minutes. You better start writing that material yesterday.
God. Yeah. Cause it's a big jump. And it's funny. I was talking to a comedian out in near the bar area of the club afterwards. He's like, yeah, I've been doing this for 35 years. And, you know, he's like settled in where he can like perform like at the Comic Strip on a regular basis and these other clubs like in New York where he doesn't have to be traveling so much, you know. And he's like, oh, it's a heck of a career. You know, it's incredibly difficult. I'm like, exactly the reason why I didn't do it, you know. But I was talking to him. He said, you know, it's interesting. It's a weird leap. It's a huge leap to go from like 5 minutes to 10 minutes, then from 10 minutes to 20 minutes.
It sounds like those units double.
When you would do your stand-up at the improv, how many minutes were you doing?
I never – because it was my show, if I wanted to do 90 seconds, I did 90 seconds. If I wanted to do 20 minutes, I did 20 minutes. Like no one could rein me in to the detriment of the show.
Well, yeah. See, I didn't have that leniency.
Yeah. I just made it up as I went, and I mean that in every sense of the phrase.
Yeah. No. So I'll have to do that again next year. So anything else on the docket we wanted to chat about this year? This year? This week?
This year, right, because this is the last one for the year. I feel like we're getting canceled. So let's just say this. Next week, we need you to really be tuned in so that you can take part in the live 200th edition of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Again, on Twitter, you're going to need to be tuned in there so you can get the link at Grizzly Bear Cafe. Our first ever venture, and probably last, into live podcasting. Not to be confused with broadcasting or narrowcasting, but podcasting. Can you believe it? 200 episodes of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. And among the things that we're going to talk about, we're going to make an effort to listen to Hats by the Blue Nile and possible further discussion of the strange subgenre that was obviously retroactively designated Sophistopop, and tons more of the stuff that you've grown to know and love from us here at the Grizz. Now, in between then and now, of course, I'll also make a Daddy on Board podcast. I'll do the trending show with Natalie. Clayton will most likely be on live television on the Fox News Network. Where else might you be?
That's going to be it. I'm still recuperating from stomach flu, so I don't intend to be much in many places. That's about it.
Oh, so maybe we Clayton will be in the bathroom a lot.
Maybe we should. Yeah, that's true. And if you can catch me there, that'd be great and terrible for you at the same time. I will say this. Maybe we should start our new show. And I don't know if you would be into this or not, if you have time in your schedule, but
– to suddenly start a new show?
Yeah. Oh, no, not a new podcast, but for you and I to discuss here on the show.
Oh.
But I just started watching – I just watched the first episode of Homeland.
Oh. If Claire Danes is in it, I'm not watching it.
No. The good news is she's not.
Oh.
That's been a misnomer. I don't know where you heard about that. She's not, and she did not win an Emmy for it. So she's.
I saw that from some semi-reputable news sources.
Yeah, no. Don't pay any attention to that. She looks nothing like Claire Danes, and she's completely different than Claire Danes.
Right. And if she's learned to act, that would really be something.
So she's this girl actually can act. She's blonde hair. She plays like a bipolar CIA agent, and she's looks nothing like the Claire Danes that's been purported to be in this show.
Good.
Completely different. Mm. As we know from Anne Hathaway's turn as Catwoman, there's potential in the ability to turn it out a bit. So, but anyway, the show is it's intriguing, and it's really good. I had thought that it was some sort of like veterans returning home show kind of thing. That's when I was first hearing about it last year, but it's not at all. It's like, you know, intrigue and CIA and Jason Bourne style goodness mixed into this story about this guy who had been basically trapped in a hole by some Al Qaeda members for like 7 years. They kept him like locked up, and now he gets to return home. And there's all of this intrigue as to his capture and all of this backstory. So it's sort of like I've heard it described as a cross between 24. And The Wire.
Mm.
So anyway, good stuff. So maybe we can kick that off as a new show that we're doing here on the Grizz. We'll see if I can convince Mike or not, if he has time.
Yeah, grumble.
And just remember, Claire Danes is not in the show.
All right. Well, that's probably the number one selling point. Well, enough of that then. We look forward to seeing you live on the 200th edition of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe coming your way in about a week.
That's right, everyone. We'll see you next week.